truth guaranteed them both hero and criminal status. By the mid-70s, the band embodied a lethal combination of rock, anti-establishment message, and mass adoration. They were shaggy men with bell-bottoms and attitude. They were hot, they were rich by GDR standards, and they were way too explosive for the regime. Performers needed a license to work. In September 1975, Rempf were called to play for the Ministry of Culture in Leipzig to have theirs renewed. Klaus gets up again to reach for a folder under the mezzanine.
"I can look up the details of my life now in the files," he smiles, "which is just as well."
He once referred to the state of his brain as dog food. I like him for his self-knowledge and smile back. Shortly before the license renewal hearing, he was offered a passport, hard currency, and a smooth ride through life, here or in the West, if he would separate from two of the most politically outspoken band members, Panach and Kunert. He refused.
"I knew then that was a death sentence for us," he says.
It must have taken guts to turn that down. He shrugs.
"It was much worse under Hitler," he says. "We would have been whisked off to a concentration camp."
The smoke is sweet and time is losing its grip on the evening. There is a guilelessness about Klaus, for a rock star. None of his answers come pat. "It's hard to describe," he says.
"On the one hand, I suppose it shows character or something, but on the other, if you're honest, you know you were shitting yourself."
He starts laughing. Then he stops.
"It looked like we'd all go to prison. That would have been the usual thing," he says soberly. "And people there were treated worse than animals. Of course we didn't want that."
Now that he has the documents from his file, he can see the sequence of events from the other side. He flicks through the folder, then stops.
"This is funny," he says. "This was from Honecker to Milker."
He reads.
"Dear Eric, please attend to the case of Gentsch Klaus as speedily as possible. Regards, Eric."
He laughs.
Get that? From one Eric to another.
But it could have quickly stopped being funny. At one point, Milker asked his officers in Leipzig,
"Why can't you just grab them? Why aren't they liquidated?"
But Rempf members were too famous to handle so directly. Klaus turns more pages and finds a formal complaint from the administration of the Clubhaus Marx Engels, where Rempf had performed a fortnight before. It is to comrade Ruth Eulschlegel, chairperson of the licensing committee they were about to face.
"You like this one," he says, and reads it out.
Klaus is the only person I know who gets such distinct pleasure from the storytelling in their file. The clubhouse administration complained about the group's drinking.
"After the end of the concert, approximately 40 bottles of wine were found. It is incomprehensible to us that a musical ensemble should require the consumption of such a quantity of alcohol to attain the right mood." It complained about belching into the microphone, use of words such as shit.
I start to laugh, harder than this is probably worth, but who cares? Klaus is swinging a leg over the side of the chair and laughing too. He continues,
"We protest the use of inflammatory calls from the stage, such as, 'It's the society that's decadent, we are the opposite. Today I feel free. There are people sitting in this room reporting on us,' or, 'You are the audience that will experience the group Rempft for the last time because we are about to be banned.'"
Klaus's laugh moves down to his chest and he starts to cough. He takes a long draught of beer and then starts rolling a joint.
"I had some Western money," he says, "so before the licensing hearing I bought a small cassette recorder from an intershop."
When performing, Klaus holds his guitar idiosyncratically upright, more like a double bass player. He runs the strap over his left shoulder, down his back and between his legs, encircling his body. While they were setting up to play for the committee, he turned the cassette recorder on and hid it between his guitar and his groin, held up by the strap. But they didn't get to play. Comrade Eulschlegel asked him to approach the desk. She said the committee would not be listening to
The musical version of what you have seen fit to put to us in writing, because the lyrics have absolutely nothing to do with our socialist reality. The working class is insulted, and the state and defense organizations are defamed.
Klaus leans in and picks up his tin of tobacco.
And then she said to us, "We are here to inform you today that you don't exist any more."
There was silence. One of the band members signalled to a roadie to stop setting up.
Kuno asked, "Does that mean we're banned?"
"We didn't say you are banned," Comrade Oilschlegel said. "We said you don't exist."
Klaus is flicking his Zippo, trying to get the flame to lick his spliff.
He sucks and looks over it at me and starts exhaling, laughing.
Then I said, "But we're still here." She looked me straight in the face. "As a combo," she said, "you no longer exist."
They were dismissed. Klaus managed to pass the tape to his girlfriend, Angelica.
"She didn't know what it was," he says, "but she knew it was important."
Angelica hid it in her scarf and took it back to their flat. When he got home after drinking all afternoon in the Ratskeller, Klaus wrote Fats Domino in big letters on the cassette and put it up on the shelf. Angelica had a Greek passport, which meant she could travel to the West. The next day, Klaus asked her to go over to West Berlin for a day trip.
To get toothpaste or whatever.
He couldn't be sure she wouldn't be strip-searched at the border, so she didn't take the tape, but he wanted the authorities to see she'd been over and back. Then he let it be known in Leipzig that he had made a recording of the decree of the licensing committee that it was now at the RIAS, Radio in the American Sector, radio station in West Berlin, and that if anything happened to them, it would be broadcast immediately. It is hard to say how much protection that gave them, if any. Renft records disappeared from the shops overnight. The band ceased to be written about or played on the radio. The recording company Amiga reprinted its entire catalogue so it could leave them out.
In the end, it was as they had said. "We simply did not exist anymore," he says. "Just like in Orwell."
Rumours were put about by the state that the band had split up, that it was in difficulties. It was, it couldn't play. Some members wanted to stay in the GDR, others knew they'd have to leave. Panach and Kunert were arrested and imprisoned until August 1977, when they were bought free by the West. The other two,
the more unpolitical ones,
Klaus says, stayed in the East with their manager. He shifts in his chair.
"Have you heard of the group Carousel?" he asks.
"No." Klaus explains that the manager who stayed with the Pliable members turned out to be a Stasi man. Under him, Renft regrouped as Carousel and went on to record Renft songs note for note.
"They copied us so exactly you can't tell," Klaus says, "whether it's Renft or it's Carousel. The Stasi was satisfying the needs of the people, but with a band it could control."
"Weren't you furious?" He shrugs. Someone else might have found this a betrayal, reason to dwell on this part of their life. After all, it marked for Klaus the beginning of a 15-year hiatus. But he has the gift of taking things easy. Cushioned by alcohol, his landings are soft. He seems incapable of regret, and anger evaporates off him like sweat. From the end of 1975, Klaus was left with nothing to do, no one to do it with. After the usual chicanery from the authorities, he was let out with his girlfriend into West Berlin. It was hard to go from money and fame to nothing. Renft's cachet did not translate over the wall. He was bewildered. His fans were rebels, and they were not here. Klaus worked for years in the West as a sound man in the theatre. After the wall came down, he found out that
"we'd become a cult band in the GDR. Our records were more expensive than a Pink Floyd album."
Since then, the band members have been getting back together, but the lineup has changed, and Panache, their wordsmith, died.
I've been reading about Panache's death lately. He died prematurely of an unusual kind of cancer, as did Jürgen Fuchs and Rudolf Barrow, both dissidents and writers. All of them had been in Stasi prisons at around the same time. When a radiation machine was found in one of these prisons, the Stasi file authority began to investigate the possible use of radiation against dissidents. What it uncovered shocked a people used to bad news. The Stasi had used radiation to mark people and objects it wanted to track. It developed a range of radioactive tags, including irradiated pins it could surreptitiously insert into a person's clothing, radioactive magnets to place on cars, and radioactive pellets to shoot into tires. It developed hand pump sprays so Stasi operatives could approach people in a crowd and impregnate them with radiation, or secretly spray their floor at home so they would leave radioactive footprints everywhere they went. Rudolf Barrow's manuscript was irradiated so it could be traced to recipients, even in the West. To detect the marked person or object, the Stasi developed personal Geiger counters that could be strapped to the body and would silently vibrate if the officer got a reading. And in the prison and remand centres, the Stasi sometimes used radiation machines as well as cameras where the prisoners' mugshots were taken. The file authority report was cautious. It found no evidence that radiation was used to kill off marked men and women, but it did find that it was used with reckless disregard for people's health, and it recommended that former prisoners of the Stasi get regular medical checkups. Although Panache died, Kuno is well, and he is now fronting the reformed Klaus-Rempft combo. They are on tour again through the old GDR, playing to sell-out crowds hungry for something that was theirs, that was untainted, and that was good. They play a mixture of old and new songs. Their 1997 CD, 40 Years Klaus-Rempft Combo, included part joke, part revenge, and part explanation for the lost years, the authentic 1975 recording of the Oilschlägel Interchange, declaring them to no longer exist. Their latest album is called As If Nothing Had Happened. The cover is a picture of a full ashtray, empty beer cans, and an open bottle of whiskey. Our conversation is sliding back and forward. Klaus is still thinking about my question of whether it took courage to turn down the initial offers to leave or to play along with the Stasi. "I don't know whether it was courage," he says. "More like some kind of naivety that protected me, I think." I think he's right here, but it's a naivety that is carefully nurtured and maintained, an innocence that he did not let them damage. "I mean, we didn't all get huge villas on the Merglesee like the Purdys, but I can look at myself in the mirror in the morning and say, 'Klaus, you did all right. Material things are not what matter to me.'" He leans back. The smoke leaving his mouth obscures it in a haze of grey and grey beard. "I think the Stasi people have been punished enough." "How do you mean?"
"Well, if they've got any conscience at all."
"And if not?" "I think of Herr Vins and Herr Christian and Herr Koch and the different kinds of conscience there are."
"I'm not that interested," he says. "I didn't let them get to me."
This, I think, is his victory. This is what stops him being bound to the past and carrying it around like a wound. If there was internal emigration in the GDR, there was also, perhaps, internal victory. He looks at me. Over the evening, he seems to have become more insightful and nimble-minded, while I am inert as a sponge.
"Do you want to hear something beautiful?" he asks.
I nod. He puts on a video of the band performing a song Panache wrote shortly before he died. Kuno looks now like a butcher or a bikie, but his voice is mellow and grand, fine as it ever was. "I sing my blues for a man who could tell you how red the dreams were in the ruins where the concrete towers are now. And do you want to know what's left of that man's dreams? Then ask the walls of cell 307 in the Hohenschönhausen. I sing the blues in red for one who can't hear me as a child in the dark
sings a song to himself. From this moment the song soars and nothing else exists. I have no body, and time stops passing. Klaus stretches back in his chair. When it finishes, he says, "You can't let it eat you up, you know, make you bitter. You've got to laugh where you can." He's right, of course, and to drink. By my reckoning, I'm pacing him at about 1 to 3, but I'm not so sure of my counting. He picks up a guitar and starts to stroke it absent-mindedly, lovingly across its curved wooden body. I see through the bottom of my glass the table, the ashtray, and the cans of beer. They look weirdly small and far away. I take my face out of the glass in a hurry and realize it's the CD cover I'm looking at. But the table is covered in ashtrays and beer cans, the same scene in 2 different sizes. It's time to go. I don't feel the cold. I don't feel much. Rolling stone. Stone rolling home. The cobbles are wet, and the street lamps make puddles of yellow light on the ground. I think of my friend in his room, singing himself happy.
Chapter 20. Herr Bock of Golm. The phone calls keep coming.
Bock.
A quiet voice, an old man's heavy breath on the receiver.
In response to your notice.
Ah, yes, Herr Bock, thank you for calling me. Before I can explain what I'm doing, he says,
I can tell you all there is to know about the Ministry of State Security. Everything you need, young woman, I can give you, because I was a professor at the training academy of the ministry. In fact, I taught special discipline.
Oh, I say, yeah?
Special discipline, he repeats. Do you know what that means?
No, I don't.
Special discipline is the science of recruiting informers. Special discipline is the art, he says, of the handler.
He pauses.
You should come to my house. It is directly opposite the academy at Golm. Do you know where that is?
No, I don't. He gives me train and bus directions. The more prone to getting lost one is, the more one tries to compensate. My grandmother has a small Spirex notepad bound discreetly to an undergarment as an aide-memoir, and I have a lot of maps. I have a 1986 map of Potsdam, in which the areas where there were Stasi buildings, anything from bunkers to multi-story edifices to shooting ranges, are left blank. On another, a 1984 map of East Berlin, entire city blocks and streets in Stasi areas are simply not represented. They are pale orange gaps in the map. Out of curiosity, I look up Golm and find that it is a gap on the map on the outskirts of Potsdam. I follow Herr Bock's instructions. I take the train from Berlin to the end of the line, and then I take 2 buses. His house is one in a street of identical semi-detached dwellings, each with a patch of lawn and a wire gate in front of it. It seems to be the only street that exists here, as though a town planner had an idea for a settlement that was begun before he thought better of it. The houses are covered in rough grey concrete, knobbly all over, as if from cold. None of them, including Herr Bock's, looks inhabited. It is late afternoon. Herr Bock's living room is overwhelmingly beige and brown. Brown linoleum and dark veneer wall units, a brown couch, and Herr Bock sitting camouflaged in it in a beige and brown diamond pattern acrylic cardigan. He has thick square glasses that give him underwater eyes and an overbite. A moustache hangs on his upper lip. His voice is so soft I have to lean into him.
You must not use my name, he says as an opener.
I agree. He relaxes back into the couch and starts to hold forth. He says that the ministry was divided into 2 main sections, internal, called defense, and external, counter-espionage. He taught a course for Stasi officers destined to work in defense.
This title is euphemistic. The internal service of the Stasi was designed to spy on and control the citizens of the GDR. The only way to make sense of its name is to understand the Stasi as defending the government against the people. I take notes like a student. Herr Bock outlines each department of the defense. I write, main departments, economy, state apparatus, church, sport, culture, counter-terrorism. East Germany is a small country of only 17 million people, but these Stasi divisions and sub-departments were replicated throughout its territory no fewer than 15 times. In every corner of the nation, every aspect of your life had its mirror nemesis in a department.
Let us take, says Herr Bock, as a specific instance the department of the church.
The church, pastors and people, was the only area of society in the GDR where oppositional thought could find a structure and could coalesce into something real. Consequently, theological colleges attracted bright and independent-minded students.
All our people had to have theological training themselves so they'd pass for members of the churches they infiltrated.
He crosses an ankle onto his knee.
How did we do it, you might ask?
He snaps his fingers.
Answer? We went into the theological colleges and recruited the students themselves.
He rubs his hands together. They make a papery sound.
You know, he says, we were supremely effective. It is not widely known that in the end, 65% of the church leaders were informers for us, and the rest of them were under surveillance anyhow.
I once saw a note on a Stasi file from early 1989 that I would never forget. In it, a young lieutenant alerted his superiors to the fact that there were so many informers in church opposition groups at demonstrations that they were making these groups appear stronger than they really were. In one of the most beautiful ironies I have ever seen, he dutifully noted that it appeared that, by having swelled the ranks of the opposition, the Stasi was giving the people heart to keep demonstrating against them. Herr Bock uncrosses his legs and spreads his knees. His feet, in socks and sandals, barely touch the floor. Outside, the light is leaving us. He is on a roll.
Now to our working methods. These were set out in directives. There were four main areas.
I write, working methods. Exposing the moles. Enttarnung. Recruitment of informers. Operational control of persons. Surveillance. Security checks. Herr Bock's passion is for recruitment.
Directive 179, he cries. 179! On the conversion of and the collaboration with informers.
He takes out a handkerchief and wipes the corners of his mouth.
There was nothing willy-nilly about it. We had to decide where in society, on objective principles, there was a need for an informer. For example, we might need one in an apartment block, a factory, or a supermarket. Then a rational evaluation would be made. What sort of person do we need here? What qualities should they have? We would find three or four people who fitted the bill. Without their knowledge, they would be comprehensively observed and evaluated in order to determine whether they could be approached or not. Most often, he says, people we approached would inform for us. It was very rare that they would not. However, sometimes we felt that we might need to know where their weak points were, just in case. For instance, if we wanted a pastor, we'd find out if he'd had an affair or had a drinking problem. Things that we could use as leverage. Mostly, though, people just said yes.
It is dark now, but Herr Bock seems to be brightening right up.
The third method was operational control of persons.
What does that mean? I ask.
Well, he says, they were controlled using means and methods. All the means and methods allowable could be used to control them.
He puts his palms together, then closes them up between his legs.
It got pretty tough for some people, you'd have to say, he says.
These were the allowable means and methods. Telephone tapping, mobilization of informers, shadow surveillance by observational forces, use of investigative forces, use of technical forces, including the installation of technology, bugs, in living quarters of the subject, post and parcel interception. That leaves only one thing I can think of. Did you use smell sampling?
Oh, no, 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 he says. That was for criminals.
Well, who were the people you were doing the operational control on?
They were enemies.
Oh, how did you know they were enemies?
Well, he says in his soft voice, once an investigation was started into someone, that meant there was suspicion of enemy activity.
This was perfect dictator logic. We investigate you, therefore you are an enemy.
We searched for enemies in all the areas I mentioned, in the factories, in the state apparatus, the church, the schools, and so on. In fact, he says, as time went on, there was more and more work to do because the definition of enemy became wider and wider.
I put my pen in the crease of my notebook and peer into the dimness in his direction. Herbock says other professors at the academy spent their careers expanding the reach of the paragraphs of the law so as to be able to encompass more enemies in them.
In fact, their promotions depended on it, he says. We talked about it among ourselves up on the sixth floor over there.
An arm gestures towards the building opposite.
And I don't mind telling you that some of us actually thought the paragraphs became a little too wide.
I nod. If by the mere fact of investigating someone you turn them into an enemy of the state, you could potentially busy yourself with the entire population.
Too wide, he continues, to be properly carried out. Within available resources, I mean.
What qualities did you look for in an informer? I ask Herbock.
Well,
he says, leaning back and clasping both hands behind his head,
he had to be able to adapt to new situations quickly and make himself belong wherever we put him. And at the same time, he had to have a stable enough character to keep it clear in his mind that he was reporting to us. And above all else, he says, looking straight at me, his eyes distorted and magnified through the glasses, he needed to be honest, faithful, and trustworthy.
I look back at him. I feel my eyes, too, getting wider.
I mean, only towards the ministry, of course, he corrects himself. We weren't interested if he betrayed anyone else.
He leans his head to one side in thought.
In point of the fact, he had to, didn't he?
He says.
Perhaps, he continues, this ability is not a great quality in a human being, but it was vital for our work. I have to say that it is the same in all secret services.
But it is not. Few secret services have informers reporting meticulously on activities at kindergartens and dinner parties and sporting events across the nation. What was in it for the informers? I want to know how much they were paid.
Oh, it was pitiful, actually,
Bock admits.
They were hardly paid at all. Every week they had to meet with their handlers, and they were not paid for that. Every now and then they might have been given some money as a reward for a specific piece of information. Sometimes they were given a birthday present.
So why did they do it?
Well, some of them were convinced of the cause, he says. But I think it was mainly because informers got the feeling that, doing it, they were somebody. You know, someone was listening to them for a couple of hours a week, taking notes. They felt they had it over other people.
To my mind, there is something warmer and more human about the carnality of other dictatorships, say, in Latin America. One can more easily understand a desire for cases stuffed with money and drugs, for women and weapons and blood. These obedient, grey men doing it with their underpaid informers on a weekly basis seem at once more stupid and more sinister. Betrayal clearly has its own reward. The small, deep human satisfaction of having one up on someone else. It is the psychology of the mistress, and this regime used it as fuel. Herr Bock is still talking, and I am still taking notes. every meeting with an informer had to take place in a covert location. In fact, he says proudly, twisting his neck towards the stairs, I have a covert location here, upstairs in my house. His upstairs bedroom is still fitted out for the purpose, with a round table and brown vinyl-covered chairs.
Every informer, he says, knew exactly what he or she was doing.
He reaches behind himself to switch on a small lamp. I look at my watch. It's 9 o'clock. If you don't mind me asking, I say, what is it you do now, Herr Bock?
I am a business advisor.
I don't say anything.
You look surprised,
he says.
You are wondering what I could possibly know about business?
Yes, I am.
I work for West German firms who come here to buy up East German assets. I mediate between them and the East Germans because the Westerners don't speak their language. The Easterners are wary because of their fancy clothes, their Mercedes-Benzes and so on.
Terrific. Here he is once more getting the trust of his people and selling them cheap. Stasi men are, by and large, less affected by the unemployment that has consumed East Germany since the wall came down. Many of them have found work in insurance, telemarketing and real estate. None of these businesses existed in the GDR, but the Stasi were, in effect, trained for them, schooled in the art of convincing people to do things against their own self-interest.
We never thought, no one ever thought, that it would all come to an end, he says. It would not have occurred to anyone that our country could somehow cease to be. Just like that. Up on the 6th floor, over there,
he gestures again with his head in the direction of the academy across the road.
At the end of 1989, we used to joke around. We'd say, last one here, turn the lights out. Because at the end, there'd be no one left in the GDR.
I think I should leave, too. I thank Herr Bock and pack up and walk to the bus stop. There is only one street lamp along this road, and it is right here, so that the bus will stop for me. I have to stand in its cone of light. I can't see much beyond it. There are no lights on in any of the buildings around. Here I am, standing in a blank on the map, lit up for all to see. According to the timetable, it is 45 minutes until the next bus comes. In 10 minutes' time, the cold will be through to my bones. I pick up my little pack and walk back to Herr Bock's. There are no lights on, but where could he have gone? No cars passed. The gate is stuck and it rattles. A piece of wire I can't see bites into my palm. I imagine Herr Bock looking through his curtains, and in fact, the moment the gate springs wide, he opens the door. He is chewing. I think I might call a taxi, if you don't mind, I say. It's 3/4 of an hour till the next bus comes, and I'll miss the connection for the Berlin train. May I come in? It is dim inside. He has turned off the lamp to watch television, and now he switches that off too. He swallows and says,
I don't know anything about taxis. I don't think they come here.
Let's try calling one, shall we? I say. He is enjoying himself here in the dark.
It might be a while, he answers. They probably have to come from Potsdam.
But he finds a phone book in the gloom anyway and calls a cab company. We sit down. My eyes are adjusting. He takes something off a plate.
You are not afraid of the dark, are you?
He says, mouth full. It is very dark.
This way, we can see the taxi come, he says.
I don't see how. All his curtains are drawn, and even if there were any light in here, no chink of it could escape to the street. I start to fiddle around in my bag, looking for I don't know what. I am buying time to think and avoiding peering at him. I am tired and hungry, and this language is not coming easily any more. This man with his brown cocoon and his conspiratorial room is unlikely to touch me, but I resent his enjoyment in having me at his mercy.
I'm worried the taxi will see a dark house in a dark street and turn around and leave. And I'm thinking of ways out of here when he gets up and peeks through the curtains. He does this in a way so as not to let any movement be seen. But he turns from the window, disappointed.
"That was quick,"
he says. I grab my things and I leave him there, all lights out in the GDR. Chapter 21. Frau Pohl. I know very little about this woman. The guide at Stasi HQ was so adamant I needed to speak with her that I just called and made a time. I take the train from Mitte to the end of the line at Elsterwerdaerplatz in the southern part of East Berlin. Then I wait for a bus to Frau Pohl's. At the bus stop, there's a Vietnamese flower seller with a stall of sad and frostbitten flowers. The GDR imported North Vietnamese socialist brothers as workers and treated them badly. They lived in camps and were bussed to work in factories each day so as to avoid contact with the locals. Now they manage as best they can. I buy the least tired-looking arrangement I can see. It's baby breath with carnations. For some reason it looks funereal. The vendor is a tiny man with a face stretched like a mummy and teeth that don't fit in his mouth. He gives me change from a leather pocket in his apron and offers me a cigarette. I take it and we smile at one another. Then he bends down under the counter and pulls out a carton of Marlboro Reds. "Cigarette?" he asks again, grinning widely. "No, thanks," I say. So this wilted flower stall is a front for black market cigarettes. Truckloads of them are smuggled in from Poland to avoid duties and taxes and are sold largely by Vietnamese on street corners at the entrance to the underground or, more poetically, at flower stalls. I like this man's cover and his generous style. A large woman in her early 60s opens the door. She has a cap of dark hair and very blue eyes in a soft face. I follow her into the living room, filled with a pair of vinyl couches and hanging potted plants. Everything here is, as my mother would say, spick and span, and so is Sigrid Pohl. Her clothes and hair are neat, and she has the tapered, plump fingers of a mournful Magdalene. In them, she is already holding a pressed handkerchief. She has made exquisite open sandwiches of mashed egg and pink meat with stripes of gherkin. Frau Pohl apologizes to me in advance.
"I lose my track," she says. "It might use up lots of tape. I have written a short biographical note."
She picks it up from the coffee table.
"So I don't depart from the theme."
She seems wobbly, a woman holding on to notes on her own life. She hands me the 2-page account. The heading reads, "The wall went straight through my heart." Frau Pohl doesn't, however, use the notes. It is true that she loses her thread and sometimes repeats herself, but she tells her story well. In January 1961, Frau Pohl, who then went by her married name of Ruhrdanz, a dental technician, gave birth to her first child. The labor was difficult, a breech birth. The doctors were changing shifts, and there was a delay in attending to her. By the time they did, she says,
"One leg was already out."
But they performed an emergency cesarean anyway. For the first few days after he was born, Torsten Ruhrdanz spat blood. He couldn't feed at all. The doctors thought it might be some kind of stomach trouble and tried to give him tea. 6 days after the birth, Frau Pohl was sent home from hospital, but her baby was keeping very little nourishment down, and he was still spitting up blood. She took him to a hospital in the eastern part of the city, but they could not find what was wrong.
"This made me very nervous," she says. "For my husband and me, he was the child of our dreams."
Then she took him to the West End Hospital, in the western sector of the city, where they gave her a diagnosis within 24 hours. Torsten had suffered a ruptured diaphragm during delivery. His stomach and esophagus were damaged.
There was inflammation and internal bleeding. The condition was life-threatening, so they operated immediately. Torsten recuperated in hospital. By early July 1961, he was well enough to be taken home, with strict instructions for his feeding and medication. Frau Paul and her husband Hartmut were to collect special formula and medicines regularly from the West End Hospital. Although there was no wall, the sector border was controlled, and they needed permission to bring over the medicines. Frau Paul applied to the Ministry of Health for the authority each time before she went across to fetch them. Over the next weeks, Torsten made slow but undeniable progress.
We were told that with this special nourishment and the medicine, he was likely to be able to develop normally, she says.
She starts to cry, so silently it is more like leaking. Tears roll down her face and she mops them up.
Please, she says, eat something.
I put something in my mouth. I look around for family photographs, but there are none on the walls, and none that I can see in the cabinets. On the night of the 12th to the 13th of August, the Berlin Wall was rolled out in barbed wire. Frau Paul lived then with her husband in this same half-house deep in the eastern sector. They didn't see or hear anything of what was going on to divide the city, but they woke to a changed world. The next time Frau Paul went to the ministry for permission to collect the formula and medicines, it was refused. She remembers pleading with the official, telling him how sick her baby was and how without these provisions he might die.
"If your son is as sick as all that," the official told her, "it would be better if he did."
Frau Paul's tears have stopped now, and her broad face is hot with anger. The couple had no choice but to switch Torsten to ordinary formula. He started spitting up blood again. They took him one midnight to the Charité, the big eastern hospital. The doctors kept him under observation and told Frau Paul to go home.
The next morning, when I went to the hospital again to see my son, he wasn't there. No one had spoken with me about it. There was no time to speak with me about it.
When they realized they couldn't help him, the eastern doctors managed to have the baby spirited across the new border back to the West End Hospital. Frau Paul doesn't know how they did it, but she thinks that it saved his life.
"I hold absolutely nothing against the doctors at the Charité. What it would mean for him, what would come of it for all of us, was not possible to foresee."
Her baby was now on the other side of the wall. Frau Paul and her husband went back to the health ministry to get permission to visit him. But crossing the anti-fascist protective measure was now a matter for the Ministry of the Interior. Frau Paul reaches down and passes me an old photograph. It is of her, smoother-faced and with stiff 1960s hair. She is holding a baby and smiling uncertainly. The child sucks his bottom lip and looks straight at the camera. His body is not visible. A man in a pastor's black cassock and white collar stands next to them, and they are flanked by nurses in hospital uniforms and wimples.
"That was October 1961, Frau Paul says. "The emergency christening."
After 9.5 weeks of separation from their baby, who once more seemed likely to die, Frau Paul alone had been issued a day pass and a visa to attend his christening. The authorities would not let her husband visit in case, together, they decided to remain in the West. She is weeping again as if she is overflowing. Everything is silent here. There is not even traffic noise. The only sound is her breath. Each morning, for an instant, Sigrid Paul would wake up like her old self, before the image of Torsten's small, sick body flooded into her mind. His condition was not improving. He was operated on 4 times in the West End Hospital. He had to have an artificial esophagus, an artificial diaphragm, and an artificial pylorus inserted. He had to be artificially fed. His parents were told again he might die.
"I went to see him that time, and "Of course, I wanted more," she says. "I wanted more."
As Frau Paul puts it in the language of the authorities,
"My husband and I decided to attempt illegally to leave the territory of the GDR.
She holds the handkerchief with both hands in her lap.
"I am not your classic resistance fighter," she says. "I was not even part of the opposition. To this day, I am not a member of a political party."
She blows her nose.
"And I am not a criminal."
She takes a deep breath and sits up straight.
"I did used to listen to RIAS Western Radio. It was illegal, but everyone did it. It was important to me to get news from outside. And in the end, it was RIAS that saved me."
Frau Paul and her husband, a boat builder, began to look for ways to be with their son. In 1961 and 1962, countless small communities of interest were forming in East Germany. People united by nothing more than a tenuous acquaintance and a desire to get out. A Dr. Hinze and his wife lived in the town of Rathenau in Brandenburg, and they wanted to join their son Michael in the West. Michael Hinze had been studying sociology at the Free University when the wall went up, and he'd decided to stay. Dr. Hinze had spoken a few times with Frau Paul's husband about building a yacht and sailing around the world. Clearly, that was not going to happen now, but it meant he knew of their plight. And his son Michael, along with some other young Western students, was involved in a scheme to get people out. Michael Hinze lives in West Germany, where I called him up. He's softly spoken and humble. He doesn't speak of what he did as if it were risking his own freedom to free others. He doesn't even sound like a modest man uncomfortable with suggestions of heroism. His tone is more that of someone recalling how he once, step by step, and in the usual manner, repaired his car. "In 1961, he says, "I was 23 years old, inexperienced in these things. After the wall went up, Michael contacted a human rights group in West Berlin. Someone there told me about a way to get people out. When the wall was built, the GDR tried to block every avenue of escape. It altered bus routes, prevented its trains from stopping at stations in the western sector, set up roadblocks along the border, and stepped up patrols to the waters of the Baltic Sea. But it is impossible to seal off a country from the outside world altogether, and certainly impossible to do it in all places and for all methods of transport at once. Trains travelling from Western Europe to Denmark and Sweden passed through East Germany, and they stopped at the Ostbahnhof in East Berlin on the way. With valid transit visas in their passports, West German citizens could travel through East German territory on their journey to Warnemünde on the Baltic Sea coast to catch the ferry to Malmö or Copenhagen. And at the station in East Berlin, there was as yet no wall, no checkpoint between the local train platforms and the long-distance ones. As it always had been, and as it is today, the check for tickets, passports and visas was on the train. A person with a West German passport and transit visa could board a train in East Berlin and ride out of there. There were maybe 8 or 10 of us, Michael Hinze says, students who were doing this. I'd say all up we managed to get about 50 people out in this way. Then he adds, I was really no big wheel. The scheme was clever and simple. It consisted of turning an East German into a West German for a day. The students asked West German citizens to give up their passports for the cause. We had no trouble getting hold of the papers. People were more than willing to help others get out of there. They chose those who resembled, in age and height and eye colour, the East Germans they were going to smuggle out. The passport holder would send off to the East Berlin authorities for a transit visa. At the same time, passport-sized photographs of the East Germans were conveyed across the border into West Berlin. When the passports came back to their owners with the visas stamped into them, the students took them to a graphic artist, who inserted the photograph of the person trying to escape.
The complete passports were then smuggled back to the East Germans wanting to leave. We would wrap 5 or 6 passports up in newspaper and stick them in the air vents of my VW Beetle. Michael could travel to the East on a day pass. Along with the passports, he would take over articles necessary to complete the East Germans' transformation into West German tourists. We brought them things like Western brand name toothpaste to put in their luggage and the driver's licenses of the passport holders. Western cigarettes too, of course, Marlboros or whatever. And we'd tell them to remove the labels from their clothes so that they didn't read People's Own Manufacture. In an alley near the station, Michael handed over the passports and supplies. The East Germans, with a case no bigger than for a holiday, prepared to leave for their new lives. By Christmas 1961, Michael Hinze's father and stepmother were safely in West Berlin. Over the winter of 1961, Frau Paul had permission to visit Torsten 4 times. Once, an envelope was waiting for her at the hospital. It was a brief note from Dr. Hinze with his telephone number and some small change. When she phoned, Dr. Hinze told Frau Paul his son would help them get out. The next time she was over at the West End Hospital, she brought passport-sized photos of herself and her husband. Michael had them inserted into West German passports.
So, in February 1962, Frau Paul says, we planned to get out using the transit route from Berlin-Ostbahnhof through Denmark in order to reach West Berlin. It was a very roundabout route.
Frau Paul is a woman utterly without irony. She seems to have, in fact, very little distance from what happened to her. Things remain close and hard. 3 Eastern students were going to escape with them. A young man called Werner Koch and another couple. Frau Paul and her husband gave their car away to a friend and sold discreetly some of their belongings. They left their home intact, full of furniture.
It was a terrible, uncertain time, she says.
Werner Koch is a chemical engineer in his late 50s. Soft-spoken and exact, he has dark hair and dark eyes in a calm face. He is dressed neatly in pale clothes and light-coloured shoes. We sit in the living room of the spacious and comfortable house he built himself, and he tells me about the escape route. A small grandfather clock strikes the half hours of the afternoon.
We got the passports and the train tickets, he says, and we learned the appropriate story by heart, who we were, name, date of birth, where we were going on our holiday, and so on.
They also had to learn where they had been. Koch's passport had belonged to someone who once travelled to Togo.
Togo, he laughs. I can't say I'm an expert on the history of Togo or anything, but I did bone up on the name of the capital, Lomé, and the language they spoke, French.
On the appointed day, the 5 of them went to the railway station. They were to stay in the waiting hall until the signal came from a Western student visiting on a day pass that all was in order to proceed. Then they were to go up to the long-distance platform and board the train. The student would phone Copenhagen to make sure the group before them had arrived safely. Then he would give the signal to go ahead. Koch doesn't remember the signal exactly. He says it was
something with a newspaper, something about how it was held.
Frau Paul seems to have forgotten or repressed details like this altogether. She says only,
there came a sign from a student that meant that we shouldn't get on the train. If we did, we would be arrested. We went straight home.
Koch elaborates. He says when the signal came,
it was a shock, but I have to say that at the same time there was a sense of relief. I knew there were things in my luggage that still looked like Eastern goods.
Frau Paul now knows that the group before them were all arrested and jailed. The Western student with them was arrested and served a 2-year sentence in an Eastern prison. The Stasi had become suspicious and overnight instituted a new stamp as part of the transit visa. In the time it took for the visas to be applied for and the doctored passports to be smuggled back to the East, this stamp had, unknown to the little group, become necessary.
We took all the passports home, Frau Paul says.
and we burnt them. Here, in this apartment.
She says this with exaggerated finality, as though the little fire washed them clean of the crime.
Then we just hoped that our son would get better and that he would come home to us. We thought, we've tried it once and it didn't work. We'll not try that again.
Failure had at least brought an end to that particular anxiety, and it felt like a reprieve. She is adamant that she and her husband Hartmut, then and there, gave up trying to get out.
That was it for us. But through this whole business, we had got to know the three students who lived here in the East.
Frau Paul and her husband corresponded with them a bit over the next year.
So it is in life that similarly minded people find each other, and we stayed in contact.
In February 1963, a year after the passport attempt, the three students asked if they might come to stay for a few nights in Berlin. Torsten was still in the West, still in hospital.
We said yes, Frau Paul says.
From then on, her conversation becomes muddled, peppered with statements of what she didn't know at the time or couldn't have suspected. She trusted the students and gave them keys to her home.
I was working full-time in my job as a dental technician, she says. So I could not know what went on in this apartment during the day. I simply wasn't here.
She fiddles with her collar.
My husband was here, she says.
Frau Paul and Harmut were nervous, Koch says of his stay in their house. It was a tense atmosphere.
The students were back to try again. A tunnel had been built from West Berlin under the wall to the cellar of an apartment block on Brunnenstrasse in East Berlin. 29 people had made it through several months earlier, but then the tunnel flooded, leaving others stranded on the eastern side. Now the groundwater had frozen, and a new escape was being planned. Chapter 22. The Deal.
I wanted to go, Koch tells me, because I had the feeling it was all perfectly organized. I thought if the danger was too great, we'd get a signal, just as we had with the false passport scheme.
The students waited at Frau Paul's apartment for word to come from a courier. As before, this attempt was being organized by Western students who would tell the Easterners where the tunnel was and when and how they could enter. The courier came with the information.
The instructions were to go to a particular street near the Rosa Luxemburg Theatre, Koch says. There, a car would be parked with a small sign on its back dash. From that sign, we'd be able to decipher the address of the building where the tunnel could be entered.
Then they were to go to a telephone booth nearby. If everything was in order to proceed, there would be a sticking plaster under the receiver.
If the plaster wasn't there, it meant that someone had ripped it off as a warning. Then it was just a matter of proceeding to the address and uttering the code words.
They were to enter the building at intervals of half an hour, and they would be shown through the tunnel. If all went well, a signal would come from the window of a building on the western side, a white flag for success. If there were problems, they would see a red ball instead.
Hartmut Ruhrdanz and I went to check it out the afternoon beforehand. We took the underground to Rosa Luxemburg station and had a look around.
They saw the car and the telephone booth, and they worked out how long it would take them to get there from the Paul's apartment that evening.
I set out by myself, and Hartmut came after me at a safe interval. He was about 100 meters behind me or so.
Koch went to the car and read the sign on the back dash.
It was some kind of riddle to do with springs. I can't remember exactly, he says, and the number 45.
Brunnen means spring or creek. Koch worked out he was to go to 45 Brunnenstrasse. Then he went to the phone booth to find the sticking plaster under the receiver. 45 Brunnenstrasse was a short way from the booth. It's also right around the corner from my place. I wandered there one morning. The sky was pale blue and high, and the sun shone like a small light in a freezer. Brunnenstrasse hits Bernauerstrasse
which is where the wall ran, and where the famous pictures of people jumping out of their apartments onto mattresses on the western side were taken on the 13th of August 1961. Now there's just a stretch of overgrown grass here. If you didn't know that the wall had been in this place, you'd find it hard to imagine. Eventually, there will be new apartment buildings built over it in the same style as the older ones, and in less than one generation, this scar will be invisible. For the moment, though, there is something strange about this stretch. It's not a park, it's not even an empty lot, it's just a hole in the city. I hunched my collar up high as I walked. I was watching the street numbers closely, looking for number 45, when I passed a shop and read its sign. I retraced my steps. I had read it right. The sign said, "Digging equipment for hire or sale. Spring diggers, electrical percussion hammers, augers, hand borers, pumps." Two young men walked past. They were tough, both of them wearing their jackets open in the cold. One's T-shirt read, in English, "Too drunk to fuck," and the other's, in German, "Out of the way, an arsehole is coming." They stared hard at me, then at the shop, then back at me again, as if to figure out what I might find so fascinating about a pump and drill place. 45 Brunnenstrasse is an ordinary five-story apartment block. Nothing distinguishes it from any other building in the street. There are no plaques on it, no footpath inlay commemorating the tunnel. And, like so many buildings in the former East, it is being renovated. As I entered, two Turkish workmen were coming out carrying tools and pails of plaster dust. I nodded a greeting as if I knew what I was doing and walked straight in. The cellar door was on the right. I stood there for a moment. Then I opened the door onto darkness. The smell of dust and damp. I started down the steps when I heard a call.
Excuse me, can I help you?
The foreman, also Turkish, stood at the top of the steps. I explained I was looking for a tunnel that had been accessible from the cellar of this building.
Wait here, he said.
He fetched a torch on a long lead. We went down the steps. The cellar had a vaulted roof and wooden partitions for each apartment section. I don't think either of us thought we'd find a tunnel. He swung the light along the dirt-floored passage right to the end, and there, in the wall, was a manhole-sized area where the bricks were newer than all the others. We shone the torch at it and stood there, and I thought of the 29 people who left their country from here, and of Werner Koch and the others. When he got to the building, Koch says,
"I went to the door of the cellar in the hall, and I said the code words. They were, 'Does Herr Lindemann live here?' It was meant to be for the people, the helpers, behind the door. I was meant to wait for the reaction. I expected someone to appear with a torch, or perhaps to speak to me, and lead me out of there."
Nothing happened. Nothing at all.
I thought, something's not right here. Please, God, just let me get out in one piece. I turned around and walked out of the building. And that's when they got me. Stasi in civilian clothes. I think there were three of them waiting on the street for me to come out again. I know now they had the building surrounded. There was one on the stairs inside, too.
They asked him what he was doing there, and he told them he was visiting Herr Lindemann.
"There's no Herr Lindemann here," they said.
They took him away, first to the police station, then into custody at the Stasi headquarters in Berlin, and finally to prison at Hohenschönhausen.
Hartmut Rudanz watched the whole thing from the other side of the street, Koch says. Then he went home, terrified.
The Rudanzes would stay in the East. They would wait till their baby was well enough to come home, and they hoped he would survive. Memory, like so much else, is unreliable, not only for what it hides and what it alters, but also for what it reveals. Frau Paul must have known why the three students had come to stay, and she probably knew that the tunnel attempt had failed. If she does not admit to having known, it is because for this knowledge she was made a criminal in the GDR, and because, saddest of all, she still feels like one. Frau Paul showed me a Stasi report on the tunnel. Its outlet had been under our feet at Brunnenstrasse and not in the wall, as this document shows in its excruciating bureaucraties. Government of the German Democratic Republic. Ministry for State Security. Attestation. On the existence of a tunnel from West Berlin into the capital of the German Democratic Republic. In the course of a cellar check by members of the National People's Army on the 18th of the 2nd, 1963, at 45 Brunnen Street in Berlin-Mitte, it was established that there was a hole in the floor of the cellar that gave rise to the supposition that a tunnel was to be found here. A widening of the hole and subsequent examination gave rise to the confirmation that in this building at 45 Brunnen Street was the end of a tunnel built across from West Berlin territory. The tunnel began on West Berlin territory, went under Bernauer Street in West Berlin and under several occupied houses in the capital of the German Democratic Republic to the cellar of 45 Brunnen Street. From the cellar of 45 Brunnen Street to the national border, the tunnel measured 130 meters and extended after that under Bernauer Street, which is approximately 30 meters wide. The dimensions of the passage amounted to 75 centimeters width and 70 to 80 centimeters in height. At the examination of the passage, four torches of Western make, one folding spade of American origin, one hand spade, two hatchets, one rock drill, as well as several screwdrivers were confiscated. Further to this, a range of light cables, several light globes and rubber mats were found at the site of the tunnel and confiscated. By means of comparisons with material already gathered to date, it was deduced that the student, name, of the Technical University in West Berlin was definitely involved in the organization of the building of the tunnel to the cellar of 45 Brunnen Street. From that time on, Frau Paul and her husband were followed. In the morning when I went to work, there'd be someone close behind me, she says. If I went into Alexanderplatz to do some shopping, a man would come with me from my front door onto the bus and train and then home again. They changed the personnel, but there was always someone there. They wanted us to feel it. Feel what? A simmering, non-specific anxiety. Apart from the fact that they were being followed, there was nothing they could have anticipated. Like most things, until it happens to you, you don't think it will. This continued for a fortnight. One morning on her way to the bus stop, two men in civilian clothes asked Frau Paul for her ID. This was quite common. You had to carry your ID at all times. Before she could reach into her bag to find it, a big black limousine pulled up to the curb. The men grabbed her above the elbows and shoved her in. I was kidnapped right off the street, she says. She didn't know where she was taken, but I knew I was at the Stasi. She now has the record of her interrogation, and it shows that she was at Magdalenstrasse, part of Normannenstrasse at Stasi HQ. She was interrogated from 8 a.m. on the morning of the 28th of February 1963 until the following day at 6 a.m. That was how long it lasted, she says, passing the document across to me. I always said it lasted 22 hours, and when I got access to my file, there it was, 22 hours. It is as if the things that happen to Frau Paul are so extreme to her way of thinking and to her sense of what life should be like that she wants to make sure she does not on any account exaggerate. It is also as if she just can't believe it happened to her. Frau Paul remembers her interrogator clearly. He was young, portly, and snide. In the beginning I denied everything, but then I noticed that they already knew a great deal. They wanted to get information about the students who had stayed with us. At the end of her interrogation, she was taken back to her cell. I could hardly speak any more. I was finished. But they didn't leave me there long. They came and took me in a paddy wagon to another place. Then they continued the interrogation day and night. They liked to do it when one was sleep-deprived. They didn't give me any rest.
It was during one of these sessions that they offered Frau Paul the deal. She was seated low on a backless stool in the corner of the room. When the door opened, it concealed her. I think of Frau Paul's ample body on that small stool designed for indignity. The lieutenant interrogating her was behind a large desk.
"I understand your son finds himself in enemy territory," he said.
"Yes, sir."
"From our information, it appears he is very ill."
"Yes, sir."
Where was this going? Had something happened to Torsten that she didn't know about? Surely they wouldn't do anything to a tiny, sick baby.
"Would you like to see your son?"
What sort of a question was that? "Yes, sir."
"That can be arranged."
I imagine the huge hope in her then, swelling her heart as she sat on that stool. But she says, "That's when I got suspicious. Here I was, sitting in the slammer, prison, sorry, and they were offering for me to go into enemy territory. That's what the West was then. I couldn't make any sense of it at all." "How is that possible?"